The reason I believe it's appropriate to begin actually with the discussion of Rosh Chodesh is because, of course, the Haggadah itself suggests that maybe we ought to begin with Rosh Chodesh. You're familiar with the Yachol Mirosh Chodesh. Perhaps we should begin, after all, on Rosh Chodesh. And I would imagine that the reason that the Haggadah has such a what appears to be a rather unusual, as we say, Hava Amina, something that I might have thought, is because, of course, the entire story of the Exodus begins, in a sense, from the point of view of the Jews, as opposed to the point of view of the Egyptians, begins with the mitzvah, the first mitzvah, Chodesh Azeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, which refers to this month's Rosh Chodesh. There was a mitzvah there both to begin a calendar, and most specifically to take the new moon and to be Mekadesh, to make it holy, to begin the new month, the new year, with the calendar that begins with that new month, with Nisan. Which means that somehow, although it's certainly between the lines, it's not obvious, but somehow the elements of Rosh Chodesh itself, of that mitzvah, must be central to an understanding of what freedom means. So therefore, the Haggadah, which is of course our book, not simply of commemorating freedom, but it's actually a book which is meant to teach us the meaning of freedom, the attainment of freedom, and so on, is all of our avodah, all of our work, all of our worship on the holidays, always means. It's always the way in which we do more than commemorate, but in which we re-experience, in which we learn. The Haggadah is a tool, and therefore it suggests that perhaps there really would be a reason to begin with Rosh Chodesh. One of the things that's troubling is why it asks Yachol Mirosh Chodesh where it does. Certainly you would think that we should ask it before we begin. It's a little bit late after we've already said the Manishtana, and we've already said the first answers to the Manishtana, Vadimayinu Lefaro Mitzrayim, that all of a sudden we should, maybe we should have started this 2 weeks ago. It makes more sense to begin really the Haggadah with this. And the truth is, if you take a look at that, I'd appreciate it. If you have Haggadot, use them, look inside. Just to get more of a look at the what appears to be a violation of the very idea called Seder. What does Seder mean?
Order.
There's organization. The Seder of Pesach is a very tight organization. It's so tight that we actually have it defined by steps, which we memorize. That's the very first thing, the simanim of the Seder. We teach our children to sing, and we actually go through it verbally, which means that apparently we're taking the organization very, very seriously. If you take a look at the internal organization of Haggadah itself, it seems to put that entire idea to a real test of belief, because anybody who's paid attention to Haggadah cannot escape the feeling that it seems to be going back and forth, makes a lot of false starts, never really completes the thought, and then, in the end, barely discusses the issues that you believe ought to be discussed, which of course would be, I would imagine, the stories from Bo and Vaera, the Makot, and so on. There's almost no mention of it. Instead, what we have is almost an introduction, and only an introduction. So, okay, it starts off easily enough with the Manishtana, so apparently we're asking these questions, and we start off giving answers. Avadim ayinu lefaro b'Mitzrayim, and it sounds like we're about to get into the story. Problem is, after exactly one sentence, we go off on a tangent. We start saying, oh, and by the way, it's very important for us to discuss this story. And now we're going to show you how important it is to discuss this story. We're going to bring you stories about people who discuss the story. So we have the people that were sitting, and they were all very wise, and nonetheless they discussed this all night, and then we have the question of whether this is meant to be in the daytime, and in the nighttime, and in the Yemot HaMashiach. I mean, it's very interesting, but it's certainly, I mean, to say that it's anticlimactic after Avadim Ayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim is an understatement. And then suddenly we go to this Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shenatan Torah La'Amo Yisrael HaTov the Pesach Mat Shavuot. And then suddenly Kineged Arba'a Banim, you must admit that the Arba'a Banim should have come before they already asked the questions for the Manishtana, right? I mean, it makes more sense to introduce the Manishtara, I would think that there's Arba Banim, these questions, and the Arba Banim can have these Arba Shailot and so on. Instead, we go into a whole discussion of the four sons, Chacham, Rasha, Tam, Sheino Yodei Lishol, and then, at last, we ask, you know, maybe we should have done this 2 weeks ago. No, that really wouldn't be necessary, because it's Vayom Ahu. And how do we know that it was meant to be tonight, and not in the daytime? Well, that's because it says Bavur Zeh. And Bavur Zeh means B'shan Shematzah Umaror, Munachim Lefanecha, you have something to point to. Bavur Zeh. Okay, are we at last ready to discuss Yitzhak Mitzrayim? Is that we finally decided it's a good thing to do? When we're supposed to do it? We already had the children, who by now are probably hungering. And so here comes the story. No. Mitzchilah of Be'a Vadah Zarah, you have a payment. We really should give you a little background, perhaps, first. The background begins before Avraham Avinu. If we're giving background, obviously we could have begun with the background, not try to fill in the background with a flashback after we already finished talking about Yitzhak Mitzrayim. But, alright, so at least it leads you on to believe that we're going to get to the story, because at the end it says that Yaakov of Anav Yardu Mitzrayim. That sounds good. So now we'll discuss what happened in Mitzrayim. No, not quite that. Baruch Shomer Avtachato Yisrael, Baruch Hu, again these Baruchs, sort of coming little nowhere. And then we go back to Avram. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avram, Netzolat Tidak, Yeri Yazaracha, Netzolayam, so on. And then, as if we forgot the main point, we suddenly make a statement of relevance. Now, I don't know of any other Jewish book that insists on proving that it's relevant. The Haggadah is only all of a sudden, in the middle of nowhere, we say, V'hi sh'avdah l'avoteinu v'lanu. Yeah, that's very nice. I'm sure it would be nice to say afterwards. If you want to mention, you want to say it really applies to today as well. I mean, some people even stand out at the Rishon. Almost everybody lifts up the cup when they say it, as if it's a central point. And I mean, it's more like, you know, everybody tries to make Haggadah relevant. You have the just a very curious Haggadah. Of course, now they look at it. There's the communist Haggadah, which tries to make relevant all of the poor workers throughout history who have suffered. So the Yishabah now becomes the statement that then you have, of course, the feminist Haggadah, the gay Haggadah. I mean, it's all of the people have been enslaved, you know, throughout history. They all have their own Haggadah. So the Yishabah, Lavatero Velado, it sounds like, you know, it's an interesting attempt to make it. What is it doing over here? But the most outrageous thing of all is that after our first non sequitur of going back to the Avodah Zarah, and our second non sequitur of Avraham Avinu with the Yisham Da, we now go to prove the fact that we were right about all of those non sequiturs, you see. Because it says, Seulamah, look, we're going to show you something. We're going to prove the situation from Lavan Harami. And we begin now a discussion of the Psukim about Arami Oved Avi Vayered Mitzrayim. Now this is the most amazing thing, because in these five Pesukim, you understand, we manage to find little hints of all kinds of things that happened in Mitzrayim. So if it says Yad Chazakah Vizran Mitzrayim Amorah Gadol Botot Lofin, that's 5 times 2 is 10. Ah, 10, I remember 10. 10 is the 10 Makot, and there you go, you start listing the 10 Makot instead of reading it straight out of the Chumash, with all of that exciting story, with all of the background, with all of the detail. This is what we have to do. We have to read this. Whatever reason we're doing this for, at last we finished Sei Ulebaz, which is proving the Hisham Da, and now we are ready to begin the Haggadah. Except that at that point we suddenly find out Dayenu, and basically it's enough, not time to eat, and that's it. We never get, it's an amazing thing, we never get to the discussion of what it was supposed to be. We had one line in the entire Haggadah Shel Pesach, Avadim Hayinu L'Faro B'Mitzri Mitzrayim V'Yotzeinu Hashem, and that's it. Right, I mean, to say that this represents the paradigm of Seder, of organization, of order, it seems outrageous. What in the world is going on over here? And there's many, many different levels at which one has to take a look at the Haggadah to understand it fully. But one thing which is fascinating is that there are strict halachic criteria. What defines a Haggadah? What does Haggadah mean? Comes straight out of the Mishnah. The Rambam brings this halacha in Hilchot Chametz Chametzah. What is Haggadah? Okay, primary ingredient in Haggadah is matzil mignut umesayim mesheva. You have to begin with discussing something that went wrong, something that reflects poorly upon us, and then you end with the change. Says the Gemara. Well, what does that mean? Well, we have two approaches. We have Rav's approach and Shmuel's approach. Rav says it means, we're supposed to say, Mitzchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoteinu. And now God has brought us close to Him. So you begin with saying what it is that we once were, far from God, and now we have managed to become a people of God. Shmuel says, no. It means you begin with Avadim Hayinu L'Faro B'Mitzrayim. We were in a state of slavery. And then we were delivered from that state of slavery, and we became free men. Now if you take a look at the other criteria of Haggadah, which includes questions and answers. The reason we know that question is because the Pasuk introduces the word Haggadah, Ki yish'al cha b'mcha, when your son will ask you, this is what you should say. However, we understand that to mean that even if a person does not have a son, does not have anybody else at the table, incredibly enough, he must ask himself the questions and provide the answers, so that the matzah, which is called lechem oni, has a double meaning. Lechem oni, of course, poor man's bread. Lechem oni, says the Gemara, lechem she'onim alav. It's bread over which you answer. Provide answers to questions. We have questions, we have answers, we have gnut, and we have shevach. And we have two approaches to the gnut and the shevach. One is mitzvah of the Avodah Zarah, one is Avodim Hayinu L'Faro B'Mitzrayim. If you look carefully at Haggadah, you recognize there are two totally separate Haggadot. One is the Haggadah of Rav, one is the Haggadah of Shmuel. Both of them incorporate questions. One, the Manishtana, the other one, Arba Avanim. They both incorporate Gnut, the Gnut being either Mitzchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah or Avadim Hayinu L'Faro B'Mitzrayim. They both incorporate Shevach, Achshav Kirvanu HaMakom L'Avodato, or V'Yotzeinu Hashem MiMitzrayim. And the other meaning of Shevach, which is praise, Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu. Each one of them ends with Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu. So what we're really dealing, by the way, not only that, even the mitzvot are repeated. We wash our hands twice. We dip twice. Each one on a separate one of these Haggadot. So we start off essentially with a duplicate of the Boar, this time in tears, from our point of view. So that the dip is the some people actually use the Boar, but the dip over here is the hint to the pain of the Shi'ibud in Mitzrayim. But that's viewed essentially as a pre-Boar dip. So that in the Mishnah, it talks about bringing out the maror for the first dip as well. In both cases, we have the washing of the hands, which is a very unusual thing. And we have, of course, at the very beginning, we take the batzot, we lift it up, that's the halach banya. That's exactly what we do at the end of the second one, in which we say, why are we eating this matzah? You'll notice we don't say the same thing at each time. And that also bears some thinking. What does one explanation of matzah relate to as opposed to the other? Why is one placed in one Haggadah and one placed in the other? But clearly, and again, I'm just zipping through this, but you'll see it yourself as a senior Seder. You'll think about this, and you will see that what we're doing here is two parallel Haggadot. So that we have one Haggadah which represents the actual events in Egypt, the Abdut, the fact that we were slaves, the other that talks about a more global historical view, which is, we were once Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Now, if you think about the conceptual distinction between these two Haggadot, it's a fascinating conceptual distinction. Shmuel's Haggadah revolves around liberty. Rav's Haggadah revolves around freedom. And these are two completely different issues. The question of enslavement, we were Avadim L'Faro B'Mitzrayim. The solution for that, the resolution, is the fact we take it out. He was Hodeas. We were once slaves. We're now freed. That means that we have the ability to live in liberty. Freedom, of course, is a much more complex idea. Please excuse me because I'm suffering from a horrible cold that I can't even fight over yet. Apologize. What freedom implies is the existence of meaningful choices. A person who has choices and is free to make those choices is free. To an individual where the choices are of no real consequences, then there is no freedom. Somebody who has choices, but his choices consist of what he's going to pick on a menu, is at liberty to decide what he wants to eat. He is not free to choose, because choice is something much more profound. It's something that has implications. Something whose consequence will make a difference to his ongoing life and his moral stature. So what Rav is saying is, liberty is insufficient. What we have to talk about is the other aspect of Yetziat Mitzrayim, and that is a long historical journey which begins in essence with Abraham Avinu. That journey is a journey away from idolatry. What in the world does idolatry have to do with freedom? Very simply this. You must remember that Abraham Avinu, and I think we discussed this on Chanukah a little bit, Abraham Avinu was not a religious figure. Abraham Avinu was a freedom fighter. Abraham Avinu had no knowledge of a God that requires worship or demands worship. He wanted one thing and one thing only: the discovery of fundamental truth. And when he discovered the notion of monotheism, it was not in a religious sense, it was in an existential sense. He came to recognize that there is a vast unity that underlies nature, that underlies everything that we are capable of conceiving of, and that points, with each succeeding stripping away of layers of explanation, points increasingly to a common center of all existence. And he recognized as well, says the Rambam, that the reason that people would stop thinking and wouldn't come to this conclusion was because of their psychological need to project a religion. And therefore he went out to destroy idolatry. Because he said, as long as people have this available, they will always stop at secondary explanations for phenomena. If you're going to explain the rain by postulating a rain god, and the thunder by postulating the angry gods in the clouds that fight against each other, and obviously any ad hoc explanation will suffice for any phenomena whatsoever. And interestingly enough, the way the Rambam opens his entire work is with the words, Yesod HaYesodot V'Amud HaChokhmot Kulam Leida Shiyesha Matzui Rishon. The central idea and the pillar upon which all wisdom and understanding is founded is the recognition that there must be a primal existence. The history of science, all historians of science, by the way, agree that there has never been a culture that is non-monotheistic that has developed a fundamental science. They have developed a technology, yes. They have developed an interesting taxonomy of various issues. Yes, certainly Aristotle did that. But the idea that you can strip away reality and find something fundamental underneath it, which is, of course, the whole basis of modern science and enterprise that has gone on for centuries, to continuously tear away what appear to be laws of nature that are themselves outgrowths of underlying much more fundamental ideas, that has only happened because of monotheism. And therefore the Rambam statement that all Chokhmah is ultimately predicated on the recognition of Matsuri Rishon, a prime existence, I think is something that any serious historian, Jew, non-Jew, religious, and I don't know if there are any religious ones, but certainly any non-religious ones, all agree monotheism is the basis. In that sense, Avraham Avinu was essentially a freedom fighter. He wanted the ability of human beings to discover truth and not to stop at their own projections, whether their projections were religious projections or whether they were just wishful thinking projections. later, the Rambam said, after we came out of Egypt. At that point was the first time that God told us he wants us to serve him. Avraham Avinu only could say, it may be a good idea to serve God because it's good public relations. Since there's obviously a very strong need in a human being to serve. Incredibly, this is what the Rambam says. Avraham Avinu never justified service of God. He felt that service itself was a projection of the human mind. You have absolutely no way of knowing, just because you may enjoy praying, and you may enjoy bowing, and you may enjoy sacrificing, whether that has any meaning whatsoever. However, because it is so much a center of human need, go ahead and do it. What the heck? Otherwise we'll lose the whole movement that I've created. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
What about the Akiva? Wasn't
that the ultimate prayer? The Akiva itself? Yes, but of course its implications in terms of service rather than recognition of source of life and so on is only evident afterwards. Certainly somebody who saw the Akedah could say God insists that there be an absolute recognition that life is not a right. But can you say more than that? Once you see that, yes, I desire korbanot, yes, I desire avodah, then you can see it as a paradigm for that avodah. But you certainly cannot extrapolate from it that it's a good idea that we should do so. Mm-hmm. Only at Har Sinai, says the Rambam, did God tell us derech avodato. There is, in fact, a way to worship God. All right. So what we're talking about is a freedom fighter. Now, and what's more amazing is that in very concrete terms, Avraham was a freedom fighter. Because Avraham had an antagonist. And this was an antagonist who is a historical figure of archetypical proportions that are exactly equal to Avraham. And I'm talking, of course, about Nimrod. Now Nimrod, fascinatingly enough, appears with a different name in the Chumash. We find in the war with Avraham, in which Avraham gets involved in the First World War mentioned in the Torah, the king of Shinar, and Shinar of course is Babel, the king of Shinar is called Amraphel instead of Nimrod, even though his name previously had been given as Nimrod. And the Gemara says, Amraphel refers to Nimrod, and the reason that he's called Amraphel is because he attacked Avraham, the Amar Pal. Amar Pal is Amraphel. Amar Pal means he said, throw Avraham into the famous Kibshanaish, which of course became now the symbol of Ur Kasdim, Ur meaning the flame, and this became now the symbol of repression. If there's any type of political activism that runs counter to the regime, crush it. So he's called Amraphel. If you consider the name Nimrod, the name Nimrod is exactly the same as Amraphel, but a reversal of language. Amar is Hebrew and Pal is Aramaic. And Nam is Aramaic for said, and Raid is Hebrew for Pal, go down. So Nimrod and Amraphel are literally mirror images, language mirror images of each other. This means that the man was actually named after his relationship with Abraham. Throughout Jewish history, we always identify the Galut in terms of some Nimrodian connection. So if you take a look at the Targum, Paro, when he first appears, is referenced as Paro, the son of Nimrod. Nebuchadnezzar HaRasha, it's called Nebuchadnezzar Ben Benosh of Nimrod HaRasha, and so on. Why? Because again, we're dealing with archetypes. So anyone that takes a stance of repression, and here I'm talking about the level of liberty, and of course that was the idea of the tower, the building of the tower, a national project in which nobody had any choice, the way that the Torah defines Babel, there was Safaka, Dvarim Achadim, imposed homogeneity, which of course only can come because somebody is imposing it. All of that was an archetype of what it means to be against variety, thinking, penetrating to any lower levels, and instead defining what it was that people would be thinking and what it was they would be worshipping. So when Avraham Avinu had to counter Nimrod, it was on both levels. On the level of liberty to allow people, of course this is, he was fomenting too much difficulty. The same thing happened to him, happened to Socrates. It was exactly the same idea for the same reason. when people ask too many questions, they create too many problems, and the regime is no longer comfortable with them. And so Nimrod ultimately attacks him. He escapes from Nimrod and begins a new life. And he's promised the land of Israel. It's part of his new life. And he says, but how do I know? B'ma'adaki Hashema. And that is the pasuk that is quoted in the middle of the Haggadah. God said to Abraham, and this is the whole reason that we went down to Egypt, God said to Abraham, you ask, how can I know? How can I know is a very profound question, because how can I know doesn't mean I don't trust you, God. It means there is a paradox involved in that commitment. If you tell me you will be giving the land of Israel to my children because you like me, I accept that. And by the way, he did. Early on in Lech Lecha, God tells Avram, L'zaracha teinat aretz hazot. And what does Avram do? He bows down and he says, thank you very much. But when God tells him, I am giving this to your children, lirishta, as a yerusha, as an inheritance, that doesn't make any sense. It's an inheritance. An inheritance would mean that it's mine. Number one, it isn't mine yet. If you mean inheritance in the sense of it is an outgrowth of my achievement, how in the world does a person pass on his philosophical achievements to his children? Well, I mean, what's to prevent them from re-examining everything that I've given them? Ah, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, an excellent question. Yadoa teda, you ask Mamayda, Yadoa teda, you will indeed know. You will know, but only as the end result of a very long process that begins in Mitzrayim for 400 years, but we also talk about Ema, Kasheka, Gedola, Nofelet Alav, a very intense darkness and terror descends upon him. And each one of those words is, says the Gemara, an insight that Avram had of other Galuyot to come. There would be other exiles, there would be other trials through which, and of course, it's exactly what God tells Moshe. When Moshe asks him, what shall I say your name was? And he says, yeah, I shall be with you in other times as I am now. Moshe says, well, don't talk about the other times, you know. So God finally says, okay, don't tell him the second name. The same, it's exactly the same idea. I relate to you as a process. And at each stage of the process, whatever it is you've achieved in understanding of me, that is what I shall be. But the point is that that process is essentially a recreation of the life of Avraham Avinu on a national scale. So that the very same things that Avraham Avinu has to go through, he is locked, as the Rambam says, locked into work esteem, stuck between people who know nothing, never had a clue as to anything beyond the religion of his own town, and had to find his own way back to life, back to light, and to discover what it meant to be human, to free the human spirit from being locked in to Avodah Zarah, which meant to be locked into projection and never to grow and never to achieve. The Jewish people had to go through their own life as Abraham and work things out in essentially the same way, but level after level, at each stage with greater and greater sophistication. And this is that center point of the Haggadah. V'hi shandala v'teinu v'lanu. We must go, each generation must discover the nature of its own identity in order to be able to achieve a greater and greater closeness, a recognition of what it means to be free. So we have over here a two-tiered development. One in which it appears that the boundaries and problems are physical. The other in which we recognize that the underlying issue is that even with liberty, we might have no freedom because we have no ability to see things afresh. We cannot deal with the issues because we already think we know the answers to the issues. So that you have two Haggadot, because there are two things that always need to be addressed. The ability, first of all, to have choices, meaning that those choices shall have consequential distinctions in how your life will be led. Not just items on a menu, whether today you eat fish or meat, but rather questions of what type of human being will I be? And of course, that's only consequential and meaningful if there is an absolute backdrop against which it can be measured. And that is Baruch Shiratan Torah Lamo Yisrael. That's part of the freedom itself. I will take you out of Mitzrayim so that you will talk to me. And I will let you know that creation is purposeful. It is meaningful, and it is necessary for you to participate in order for you to be yourself. And because of that, your choices will be extremely consequential. And the implication of each of your choices, and the more sophisticated you become, of course, the more you will notice the details of those choices. When someone is all black and white, then his choices are black and white. But as a person becomes more and more aware, then each moment of life presents new, it appears to be very subtle challenges, moral challenges. However, you take the first step in one direction, and the next step in that direction becomes a little easier. And what began as a minor moral challenge can become absolute perversion and self-deception in a very short time. So that the idea of heightened sophistication, heightened awareness, knowledge of greater difference and distinction is what freedom is all about, of course, is what the Haggadah is all about. It's the Ben HaChacham who is capable of being more free, not because he's more intelligent, because he's more aware of distinctions that bother him. When somebody says Mazot, then his level of freedom. Sorry. I was reduced to wearing my children's watch so I could have two times. But it helped not to talk too long. The Israel time and local time.
I got Israel time and
local
time.
Yeah,
one watch.
Yeah, I did that too, and one of them went dead on me. So we have over here, therefore, an insight. I think it's an insight, really, into one of the fundamental aspects of Judaism. And that is that we do not have a conception of just freedom, nor do we have a conception of just liberty. We recognize that people that are at liberty, by the way, in the United States we talk about a land of the free, but it's not. It's a land of liberty. If you take a look at the entire process, the ideas that were embedded in the, essentially the revolution, were ideas that were based on liberty and not freedom. Because on the contrary, we wanted to avoid here, and we see now the fruits of that, we wanted to avoid here any notion of an absolutist system of morality against which a person's actions could be measured. And this, of course, was the entire idea of separation of the issues of liberty, which were to be provided by the state, and the issues of freedom, which were provided by the individual human conscience. Therefore, on the liberty bell was written the pasuk from the Torah that specifically does not talk about chayrut. Chayrut meaning what we think is freedom, but we misuse the word. The word chayrut in Hebrew, it comes from the word for choices. Bechira, freedom of choice. My choice is my chayrut. There is no clear English concept of freedom. But the pasuk that was chosen for the liberty bell was the word for dror, liberty. And we quote the pasuk, Kraten dror, you shall call out liberty in the land of Kol Yosheha, and that was placed on the liberty bell. Very, very consciously and with full understanding of the implication. Dror, says the Gemara, comes from the word for liberty of place, dar, you can live wherever you want, and dari, you could carry on business, free trade, without government involvement. And this is exactly what the idea was in essentially the American concept of what liberty was all about. Gabriel Tal told me today that the original version was not the pursuit of happiness, but rather the pursuit of money or financial gain. But this, of course, is the idea of war. That's the whole point. When it comes to freedom, however, we see very much in front of our eyes a country with vast liberty and with very little freedom, in which people feel that all choices are essentially equally valid. The postmodernist vision is that you simply have different strokes for different folks. There are no criteria by which we could determine any type of absolute morality. And therefore, it becomes a solipsistic argument in which I say, since this is the morality I wish to have, guess what? It happens to be the morality I do have, just by coincidence. Which, of course, is precisely the Avodah Zarah projection. I project the morality against which I measure myself. Exactly the same as projecting a God against which I now measure my performance and my worship and so on. So this was never a country that was meant to be free. It was a country that was meant to be at liberty. And indeed people suffer tremendous malaise and sense of worthlessness and inconsequential feelings because there is no real sense of freedom. So here we come to the crux really of Judaism to a great extent. The recognition that liberty without freedom ultimately is lost. Because someone who has more commitment than you have, this of course is what happened twice in this century, is that the great democracies were almost destroyed by those who would be Nimrodian in their assertion of, we will do it our way. Am echad, safa echad. And the only reason that they were saved was because, through the mercy of heaven, individuals arose who were capable of motivating, on a very subliminal level, the democratic people to believe that there is a difference between being a fascist and being free. And that's worth dying for and worth fighting for. And the so-called great philosophers who later came up with the idea of better red than dead, of course, that is exactly the point. There is nothing worth dying for, because obviously life would be the greatest value, however it is. And that ultimately the end of liberty.